And it doesn't mean we roll over everything walking in the door, but it means that we need to never get so hardened that we're not sensitive to the folk who walk in. And that's my whole point in that one. That thank you very much. I thought she was a tough dictator, but she's really a gentle person. She gave me a cough. I won't let that get around, Carol. Thank you. Thank you very much. All of this stuff kind of comes together over time. You see a decrease. I was just talking with Jerry about that. You see that sort of product of what we're talking about, a decrease in active work outside the group. I won't visit this too much, but one of the things that started to become part of our fiber, you know, when this treatment influx started to happen, we started to see some changes in how we do meetings. We started to drift, and I mean, like I say, I'm not criticizing how people do treatment. What I'm criticizing is how we perpetuate that process. Because what we've drifted into is an unbelievable proliferation of meetings that have little to no structure, and where the focus of the meeting is whatever happens within the hour that it gathers. Nothing else. Absolutely nothing else. That it's a group of people, probably good folks, who meet for good reason. But it has no history, no life that precedes the meeting, nor any that follows. You know, it's an experience that's confined to 1 hour. You know, and so while it may do little harm, it's a kind of a shaky place for us to rapidly move, and the movement is in that direction. I mean, preponderantly in that direction, right, all over the country. You know, not just in North Carolina or Cincinnati, but it's all over the country. And it's understandable because it's, in all honesty, I think it's the easier, softer way. And it's attractive because it's almost a no-brainer. Yeah. You know, if you look at the construct of a meeting, my God, they can almost be spontaneous and often are spontaneous. You know, like we were doing a little spontaneous planning, but we were modifying a plan, not making up one. We knew what we were going to be doing here. I knew what my topic was. I just forgot it for a while, but the boss lady reminded me, said, you better not be talking about relationships. You better. our drift overwhelmingly is toward that. I tell you this. Of all the things that I'm concerned about in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's my number one. My number one is that absolutely exponential growth of those little lightweight meetings and the demise of strong, well-ordered, purposeful groups. That is my single number one greatest concern in AA. And it's not just because of bias about quality of meetings. I think that probably is obvious. It's if we drift into a preponderance of just lightweight meetings, where does leadership come from? Where does a group conscience form? Yeah. You can't have a meeting conscience. That's like a meeting conscience in a bus station or the airport tomorrow. Yeah, I mean, you can't do that. So where do we soberly, pardon the pun, but soberly consider the things, you know, when Bill died or when he wrote Traditions, he said, I think the time has come for this fellowship to govern itself instead of having two benefactors to govern itself. He said, as long as we do these principles and studiously avoid these mistakes, we'll do well. I would suggest to you that we're drifting pretty mightily away from the admonition of Bill Wilson. And so it is a big concern to me. If you look at the average group, you're not going to find, it's going to be one legacy. One legacy. 99.9% of the time, it's going to be recovery, and it's going to be pretty much me and my problem type of orientation. It's going to be about recovery. And it may be a healthy thing about recovery, but you'd be pretty hard-pressed to find a time when traditions or the service work or the quality of our representation or the selection of a GSR, be hard-pressed to find that. And so when you look at that, you've got to reckon with, so what about our future? What is it that assures the well-being that a healthy program of Alcoholics Anonymous is going to be here? I hope that you're concerned about that. I hope very much. Nobody can make you be. But if you really mean it when you say that you want to be helpful to other alcoholics, sometimes we have to go beyond just what's immediately in front of us. If you really mean that, when you really say that you want to be of maximum service, you got to think of more than just what I put my hands on. I have to recognize, and I do, that my group is a part of my identity. It's not just a place I go. It's my most fundamental commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous. My group meets twice a week, closed meetings on Monday night, open speaker on Thursday night, and those are commitments. Those are not under the heading of nice to do. Those are under the heading of gonna do. And unless there is some major league kind of commitment or I've agreed to do something that I really thought was a more important service on a given night, that's where you're going to find me. I'll add this one little caveat to that. Because just like everybody else, I got a family and all that kind of stuff. And those commitments, while they're pretty adamant in their nature, they're very important in my family. Because my family knows that that's a part of who I am, and therefore they can trust me because I do what I say I'm going to do. Now, everything else is negotiable, unless I get it on the book. You know, now, if I get it on the book, it's a commitment. Coming to Cincinnati was a commitment, but it wasn't, you know, when she first called. I'll give you an example. My son is I thought he had a great future as an AA member, but he got through it, and he became a high-risk surgeon in maternal fetal medicine. Jesus, I mean, you got to be kind of goofy to do that. But he's doing it. He thinks he loves it. So more power to him. When he finally got self-supporting through his own contributions, he came to visit one time, and he said, "Hey, Dad, I'd like to take you guys out to dinner tonight." I said, and I didn't say a word. I guess he must have seen a look or something happened. He said, "Oh, wait a minute, this is meat night." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Oh, okay, well, we'll do that later." Well, see, it was no big deal. But suppose I'd have put that in terms of, "Oh, no, son, I told Tony that I'd go coffee with him tonight." Well, that would have been a different deal. If I'm going to pull something in and make it a value judgment about what's more important, that would have been a real hurtful thing. So a commitment is an important thing because folks can trust me and they know what I'm about. It's also important to me because it gives me a foundation. That's a part of my steadiness and my strength in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because as you gathered from my conversation with Phil, a little bit, is that my home group is where I do my work. Now, this is important. What I'll do in the morning is important. But my real important work, my most important work, is what I do in my home group. That's where I troll for drunks. That's where I look for Phil coming to the door. And boy, I tell you what, if he don't want to get hugged and met, he better hide. Because I get it, I'm going to be on him big time. And that's fundamental. So the point of all that is that if I really want to be of service, I got to get beyond just me and mine and what I need. You know, it has been so long, God knows, since I've gone to a meeting with any conscious thought about what I need that I can't even come close to remembering. That's not what I go to meetings for. I've got a sponsor for that. What I do is to go and be of service, to be a part, to be a contributor, to find what I need. And when I do that, my God, mine's a given. I don't have to think about it. It's a given. It's a direct product. When I make old Phil welcome, I don't mean to beat you up, buddy, but you're close. When I make old Phil welcome, guess who's more welcome? Better believe it. It's a selfish program, eh? It's a selfish program. And so when we start losing the groups where that kind of experience exists, we do it at the expense of our overall work. We do it at the expense of our solidity, of our reliability. And then the whole deal of what I was talking to Jerry about is that in a more casual gathering, where you just sort of get into that sort of continuation of aftercare dialogue, you don't get into things like active service. You don't get into that kind of stuff. That little exercise I did in the beginning about, and I wasn't just playing with you, it really makes a point, I think, that about naming the historic figures that were so prominent in the development of AA. And we really do draw a blank when we try to think of a comparable list today. It's not because we've outgrown our need. It's not because of that. My God, we need cooperative relationships as desperately as we ever have. But when you're just into sort of discussion type me and my recovery type stuff, that doesn't occur to you. You don't think about that. And so when those days come down, those days, you know, when treatment is no longer number one access point, I really trouble about how well we will respond, how responsibly we will reach out. And so I don't know. I probably don't need to tell you anymore that it's a concern to me, and I hope it is. I hope it is to you. That old slogan, I think it emerged at the 1960 International Convention. It was, let's be friendly with our friends. When that was done, there was a stage full of our non-alcoholic friends that were there. And it was, I thought, a real high point in history. And it's a relic of the past, almost. That term is almost a relic of the past. That whole thing of actively working with people and reaching out. I'll just say one more thing about that. I only got about two more hours worth of material. I'll just say one more thing about that. One of the things that's happened in our sophisticated society is I just sort of have to say it down home to make it plain. It's a kind of a capturing ethic that's set in our society. In terms of alcoholics. Remember that thing I mentioned early on about Abby and the court and how Roland made the plea to the court to give me this guy? That has now done a 180. Today you still have people. There you are, Jerry. I've been looking for you, boy. Jerry's so humble I couldn't even see him. But this Roland and what he did there was the way we used to do it. And if we had a judge, no judge took initiative to do it on his own until a couple AA members and a couple of just bold souls started to step out of it. But every intervention that was done was because one of us would go to the court and say, hey, don't give him a chance, give us a chance. Let's see what we can do with him. And so, but now it's 180 degrees, eh? We were talking about a drug court. You could not get a more polar opposite of what Abby and Roland did than what a drug court does, nor any other court, where they try to remand alcoholics into AA. And it's a totally different deal. Now, if you're back then, if a judge came to me, he'd literally get a standing ovation. Today, if he came into the average meeting, he would probably be either suspicious of him or angry with him or wanting to vent something with him. And so it's just done 180. And so we're not doing that kind of active outreach stuff, you know, to try to foster and develop those cooperative relationships. And that doesn't, it's gotten so dismally in the past that I've actually had people to ask me, doesn't it violate tradition if you enter into an agreement with a court or a driver's license taking outfit or a drunk doc program? You know, aren't you violating tradition? I mean, my God, we've just let it get so far removed, we don't even recognize it as a viable part of 12-step work. So those things will just tend not to get done. And those capturing deals, I'll just give you a couple examples of what I'm talking about. You've got them right here. I don't know what they are. But I guarantee you, if you want to target people anywhere alcoholics hit the wall, it doesn't matter. There's a wide range of things in Cincinnati where alcoholics hit the wall. Anywhere they hit the wall and somebody deals with them is where we need to target our cooperative relationships. Because the average professional today doesn't know how to make a simple recommendation or referral to AA. You think everybody knows? Don't kid yourself. Most of them give it the same old salute that they used to 60 years ago. What do I do with this guy? So there's huge work. I'll give you this example that one night we were sitting in a committee. My home group has every service committee that exists in AA. Every one of them is working in my group right now. And one night we were sitting in the corrections workshop, and I was chairing a meeting. We got through with the agenda we had. And I said, what do you guys think about tackling those court slips things? Those things always bug me about those things. And one guy said, oh, God, Tom, you can't do anything about that. Man, they do it all over the country. And I said, yeah, I know that. But let's don't tackle the whole country. Let's just see if we can do it right here in our little old community. And he said, well, we can try. We won't get anywhere. But it was interesting. An interesting activity at I didn't have much of a mind. I never would sign those things. I really felt for the guy with the paper. And somehow it just seemed clumsy for me to move into an approval status with this guy. And so I'd always wimp out. Yeah, they'd ask me about it. Oh, no, Kathleen will take care of that. I wouldn't tell Kathleen. I'd just say, go get her. Yeah, I mean, if I knew she was amenable. She's got pen, her own pen. Says Holiday Inn on it, though, I'll tell you that. But, now, that was a wimpy way to deal with that. So I said, well, let's try it. I was on a plane one day going somewhere, and I do my best writing on a plane because I'm away from phones, and the air's thin, and my mind wakes up, and so I was writing. I thought, why does that bother me so much? And you probably do the same thing if you're troubled over it. Why does it bother me so much? So I wrote down the old advantage-disadvantage thing. You know, what's the plus and what's the minus? So I wrote it on my beagle pad there, and I wanted to be open-minded, so I put down the values first. What value would anybody see in this process? Who is it going to be helpful to? So I had 10 items that were potentially helpful. 10 of them were helpful to the criminal justice person, the probation officer. All 10 of them were helpful to them. They were what you expect, paperwork, you know, you show signs of help, you know, there were a number of things. I put question marks by 3, which maybe in your wildest dream might be a little helpful to the drunk. But I didn't really believe it. That's why I put a question mark. But none were clear winners. Now, I've known the odd case, but God, I've known thousands who've gotten so aggravated they wouldn't come to AA on a bet by being harassed like that. So on the disadvantage side, I started writing, so what's the matter with this? I think I wrote 26 things, and I mean in short order. I didn't have to do any research. And they would be about what you'd think. It brands a guy. I mean, he can't come to a meeting like anybody else. When he walks in, he's a second-class citizen at the door. It might as well stamp it on his forehead, you know. And it assures that he's going to have a distorted introduction. Now, that's not what we are. We're not a compliance factory. You know, the one I wrote down put words to why it troubled me. And it said, when I do that, it changes the character of the relationship I want to have with another alcoholic. The only thing I want to be to an alcoholic is another alcoholic, just like Bill and Bob. But when I take on some validating function so that I sort of arrogantly, you know, a lot of times I don't even look at the guy. Oh, yeah, I'll sign that for you. You know, patronizing junk. I just think it's just a terribly, terribly, potentially hurtful thing. And so it was Bobby. So I wrote down, I think, 26. And I edited it down to 20. So we went in and started to meet with the fellow that we decided to meet with the head of probation rather than the judge. And he was a little, just like any kind of agency guy, he was a little defensive, you know, and he thought we were attacking him. And then when he caught on, we weren't attacking him, we were just talking shop. And so he started looking at that list, handwritten. I didn't have time to get it typed. It was handwritten from an airplane. No, I got my wife to rewrite it so she'd have a little piece of the action. She's Al-Anon, very helpful girl. Plus, he couldn't read about it. He got down to that one that I just described about why I wouldn't sign him, and he said, well, I'll be damned. I never thought of that. I said, me either. And he said, well, what do you think we ought to do? Now, my note, I'm telling you a little bit about this in case you want to jump on something. I know Jerry's got some concerns in this area. He said, well, what do we do about it? And I said, when I'm going to criticize something, I'm going to have a solution at the same time. I never attack anything that I'm not prepared to offer a solution. So he said, well, what do you think we ought to do? I said, funny you should ask. And so we'd put down four things that we thought would be possibilities. One of them simple. I can't remember the other three, but the one of them was real simple. Was do a 180 on him. Let the guy tell you what he's going to do. Instead of you telling him what he's going to do and having him prove it, turn it around. Let him sell you. That's what they decided to do. Then they asked us to meet with all probation staff. There hadn't been a piece of paper in my group since. So some of these things that you think are carved in stone, the missing element is us stepping forward and say, hey, guy, we may have a better plan. And that works better for everybody. One of our members, anyway, just last week, one of our members said, Tom, we got to do some more stuff at that probation. One of the officers told me the other day, said we needed to just visit them some. So that thing's cracking. Yeah. One other, and I'll just mention this, that we're working on right now. We've done some stuff with judges and things. I've got a real interest in the drunk. They got a fancy name for this, but I just call it the drunk lawyer program, where they capture lawyers. And I did some work with them. I did some little workshop stuff, and I spoke at their convention one time, the lawyers and stuff. And I had dinner with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of North Carolina and a couple of other justices. And when I got up to speak, I knew the Chief Justice professionally, but I didn't know him. I never had sentenced me, but he didn't know the intimate details of me. And so I got up, and they basically wanted me to tell my story, and I did. And I started out, I said, it's a real privilege having dinner with the Chief Justice and these other folk tonight, and all you guys. I said, if I'd have had dinner with him a few years back, it would have been for my last meal. And he caught on what I was talking about when I told the story. But I was fascinated by that because one of the things, and I'm going to flesh this out just a little bit, because I'd love to see you spring into action on something. And it'd be about the same kind of a drill anywhere. What happened, and I'd really listened closely. I was listening for any signs of optimism and heard none. You know, my perception was that the lawyers got so lost in this maze of trying to get from captivity and follow-up and monitoring into recovery that was their own, that they got lost in it. And for good reason. You know, that, I tell you what, put one of the things put me onto it. I sponsored a doc, and one night I was talking to him, and he looked at his wife. He said, oh, geez, I got to go. He called the name of another doc that he was sponsored. He said, I got to run and see him. And I said, what for? It was 10 o'clock at night. He said, I've got to take a sample. I said, you got a what? He said, take a sample. I said, no, you don't have to take a sample. And he said, well, yes, I do. I mean, he's under mandate from the medical bunch himself. And he said, "My God, yes, I do. They've told me I have got to monitor this guy." I said, "Well, I tell you what you do. You call them or write them and tell them that you cannot take samples." And he said, "Well, what will I tell them?" I said, "Tell them your sponsor said you can't take samples." So he did, and he doesn't. And the other doc, by the way, was at a meeting Thursday night. He's doing okay. But you see the bind that puts in? Well, how the hell are you going to be a sponsor and a monitor and taking salary? That's goofy. I mean, those are totally contradictory positions. But that's what happens. These aren't done by ill-intended people. These things are done by well-intended people. They're doing the best they know how. Because what you and I understand about what it takes to enlist a person into recovery in AA, they haven't a clue about that. And the reason they're ignorant is because, by and large, we have not bothered to say, "Hey, can we be of help?" And all you're trying to do is figure out, instead of a gray maze to get through, how can we move in and cooperate so we can help with a sensible transition? Ran into the guy that directs those. He's an Al-Anon, by the way. Al-Anon guy that directs that program in North Carolina. I knew him a little bit, so I did some stuff for him. But ran into him one day, and he asked me what was I doing. I told him I said, "By the way, there's one thing I'm working on a little bit you might be interested in." And so I told him a little bit about what I've just told you, about my concerns in that area. And he said, "Well, what are you going to do?" I said, let me just get you to think with me about something. Suppose we took a table and we set down a bunch of you guys on that side and a bunch of us guys on that side and just kind of reasoned together. You suppose we could work out some kind of... He said, "Man, that's great. Just be sure I got a seat at that table." Yeah. See what I'm talking about? A simple little thing. I mean, it's not rocket science. It's not about trying to take on thing and understand the legal profession. I couldn't care less. I had more of the legal profession than I cared for. I have no interest in that whatsoever. All of these programs that are well-intended but futile in effectiveness because of these kind of compromising features are well-intended. You know, but there are places where the missing quotient is us. It's us. Failing to step forward and actively carry this message. Doesn't say we wait till they come in the door and then we tell them about it. It says we carry this message. And failing to do that, I think, is part of the stuff that's very, very difficult to deal with. I have a clue about time. I don't know if I'm going to deal with any good news or not. I'm kind of in a bad mood today. There's a lot of stuff happening. Well, I'll tell you one other real negative thing. That is negative to me. If you go back to that thing that Bill said about what will assure the steadiness of our future, it kind of reflects off that a little bit. How we do business, theoretically, is we're a grassroots-driven fellowship. Do you know that? The inverted triangle, eh? That the real power in AA is among the groups. And that what will keep us steady and strong and congruent with the needs of the alcoholic is a grassroots-driven thing. That's why we say that the GSR is the most important person, because that's the link to the fellowship. And without a viable GSR function, there's no link. And so what you got is a bunch of free-floating drunks over here that have no relationship to the fellowship in terms of how you do business. Why is that a problem? I just finished an area of chairmanship of a committee a year or two ago. We get about 21% representation when we make our important decisions. About 20 or 21%. 25 on a real boom season. Is that a grassroots-driven fellowship? That's a minority opinion at best, at best. So when you think about the important issues that confront us in AA, we wind up with, thank God we've got a dedicated group of people who are prepared to take up our slack. I was doing a little deal up by New York City over in Jersey, just across from New York City, and the chairman of the Board of Trustees, a nice man, did a little something on concept, and I did something. At a break, I went over to him, and he's the guy that's almost like our voluntary general manager of the world. You know, he's a real leader in serving. And so I went over to him, and I told him, I said, let me just run something by with you. So I laid it a little bit out of just my concerns. I didn't have to explain a lot because he knew what I was talking about. I said, what I'm hoping you'll tell me is that you have a different view of this. I want you to tell me you have a different view. For God's sakes, throw me a bone, man. And he said, I wish I could, but I see the same thing. Well, what concerns me is how many people see the same thing and do nothing. Yeah. If you see the problem, I think the deal is to step forward, not back up. Yeah. And so we're lacking a lot in that business of being willing. And where do you learn that thing? If you don't have groups that deal with agendas where you get into principles and what service is about and solidify these things, naturally, you're not going to step up and say somebody needs to do something here, and so it is a huge, huge kind of a deal. Oh, that was a question. I said, I got him. He's going to join. I'm old but quick. Well, I tell you what, we're going to have. Okay, all right. Yeah, the captain, I think, mandatory AA. We got a lot of that. It's a part of that thing, and we set up a meeting just a while back at a prison. And when we set up a meeting at a prison, when I've got anything to do with it, we meet number one with the head of that facility, not his deputy or her deputy. We meet with the number one person, or we don't meet. Simple as that. And because if you don't get the top person it bought in, then he becomes a question mark. And so we just don't want question mark. So that makes everybody else uncomfortable about how to deal. So we did. I always tell them that the meeting will be short. And it'll be the only one we have unless something goes wrong. And so we go at it. And during the course of our meeting, we only plan 1 hour. That's the most I ever plan. And they wouldn't let me quit at the end of an hour. We got talking about mandatory meetings. A guy told me they had a therapeutic community there, which is a type of a treatment program, and it's kind of a boot camp type of deal. He said, those fellows, everything they do is mandatory. And he said, how are you guys going to get along? I said, oh, that's cool. We'll get along fine. We'll be good neighbors. Mm-hmm. And he said, suppose they want to come to the meeting. I said, it'd be fine. As long as they ain't marching. But if they're marched in, we won't be good neighbors. And he said, all right, well, we won't be doing that then. And so, they were really intrigued with why I felt so strongly about that. And I put it to you in simple terms. When you make it mandatory, you guarantee failure. You can pretty well say that across the board. Now, certainly you'll get a notable exception, but you can bet that's what it is. You can bet that's what it is. So we don't do that. The thing that I guess maybe I would like to I share two more experience, one experience, and then just one sort of a philosophical base, I guess, that we can do ruffles and flourishes around that. I want to give you one other example on a court thing. You probably got some here. I won't ask you, but you probably got some kind of a march-in type of place that. That you're worried about. I'll give you this, throw in this little example. I took my wife down to you. Normally, I'm doing something when we go somewhere. She goes with me. I just decided, I said, would you just like to go down to, she never had seen Disney World. Me either. I said, you want to go down that thing and just do nothing, just goof off for 3 or 4 days? She said, yeah, I'd love that. I said, all right, good. And so I wanted her to get a set of the rat ears that they wear down there. And I tell you, I got them. And the old girl looked pretty good in them, and particularly with nothing else on. She looked good. Good girl. But we did. Oh, God, I forgot what tape is. She probably said my wife. Well, she did look good. I wanted to go to a meeting, so I just called up the office and said, in meeting out this way? And said, yeah, there's one real close to you. Told me how to get there. Went over. Weird kind of a deal. I pulled up beside it, and there was one guy sitting out by the back door, and I just looked out, and he said, yeah, this is it. And I said, all right, good. So we went in, and we determined it was open, and so we went in. He was the only guy there. And then about 2 minutes till 8, it looked like a line of ducks coming in. There was this line of people came in, and I thought, what on earth is this? You know, they're like they're marching to the guillotine or something. And so he started meeting, and he read something, and then he got me to read something. And then we went for a few minutes, and he said, Tom, you probably noticed this is not your regular meeting. I said, well, I had noticed a little peculiarity. And he said, well, this is a mandatory meeting. Yeah, these folks all on probation, they just left the probation office, which was next door. And so that's why they were so happy. And now you talk about Grim City. And so, now, I still got a little bit of, just a little bit of gray matter left. And I knew there wasn't no point in haranguing these people. And so I said, man alive, I'm glad to see you guys. I've been worried for a long time about whether doing what you guys are doing is effective or not. Does it really do anything? And so tell me what you think. Well, God Almighty, you talk about a lively meeting. Man, they just came out of the seat. Well, there were no positives. I guess you know that. And so you offered us a product. And I thought, I in fact asked you, I said, why are you doing this? You know, the ego, why are you doing this? Good God. It was just a pointless deal. So what do you do in a deal? I'll give you one example that I ran into it out in Colorado, that a fellow, old crusty old boy named Truman, a nice guy. Crusty, though, God knows, he like George Patton with AIDS. He just is a really run-down guy, but he is tough as nails and good guy. He told me, in fact, they had three judges on Saturday morning sitting at the conference. And I thought, these guys got to be on house arrest or something. And you don't get judges out on Saturday morning. He had three of them sitting there. And so they started telling me about it, too. And what they do, and it's the most real profound things are simple. And what they do in Colorado Springs, they wanted to set up a program. And when they got through with the program, what they had was they do a meeting. They do a mandatory show-up meeting that's not an AA meeting. On the given night, the probation people supervise the showing up of the people. And they set a door right out, a chair right outside the door. So when somebody comes in, check off. Kathleen's here. Check them off. They go in, and then Truman and a couple of other folks say, okay, guys, you've just left your probation. We have nothing to do with that. You know, what we're going to do is tell you about AA. That's what they've asked us to do. We'll tell you about AA. And everything that's done inside that door is done by AA members. They serve some coffee. They pay for it. They provide literature. They pay for it. They conduct that meeting. They've got an absolute policy that if the probation person, the AA member, doesn't show up, there'll be no meeting. There'll be no, the probation guy's not going to come in there and wing it and read a pamphlet to them. There'll be no meeting. That has never happened. There's always been somebody. If the probation person, which has happened a couple of times, doesn't show up, one of the guys will go to the door and say, sorry, fellas, there's no meeting tonight. Now, that is profoundly important. That sounds simple. But what happens when you start to getting affiliated is when you start losing those lines between what is and what isn't. And so that's been an eminently successful program. And it's so simple you wouldn't believe it. It's almost remedial. A guy sponsored out in Oklahoma wanted to do it, and that's where I sent him. He went over there and sat in on a session, and they started one 2 weeks ago in Oklahoma City, modeled after that. So it's a simple thing. And if anybody wants any information on like that, Carol's got my email, and you're welcome to contact me, and I'd be glad to put you in touch with Colorado or whatever. I'll send you one we've got on the court slip stuff. Last thing I want to just mention here is this thing of I got at it a little bit here, but I want to just kind of close up on this again. If you look at the steps, you know, the way I like to look at it, I break them down. The first three is about surrender, and that's that foundation, like Bev was talking about, the spiritual foundation. I like to look at those first three steps as the real foundation from whence recovery grows. And then the next four through seven are essentially about, you know, really understanding what my alcoholism is about and starting to open those doors a little bit. And then the rest of the eight and nine, of course, are there the restoration, the freedom steps at eight and nine. Then we get to 10. And there's a line in here that you rarely hear talked about much, but I'd like to just draw your attention to it. In the middle of the page down here, right after the start of step 10, it says, "We have entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness." To grow in understanding and effectiveness. And you know that 10 is where it starts to put these principles to work as a way of life. To start making it a program where we can absolutely insist on enjoying life. It starts to put those principles in. And all that means to me, very simply, is that if I want to be helpful, all I got to do is take a look at a situation and try to understand. You know, understand what's the deal here. Understand what needs to be done. Because effectiveness to me is a very little used word that has vital importance. I kind of jokingly referred to the fact that when we do something one time, it becomes a sacred tradition. That is much more true than false. It doesn't matter whether it works or not. I did a program in Princeton, New Jersey. Okay. I did a program one day in Princeton, New Jersey, in a very enlightened community. It's the home of Princeton University. And it's a few folks had started a program up there to deal with folks like I'm talking about, kind of captured a bunch. And so they set up a meeting so they could give them a royal welcome when they came into the program. I was chatting with a couple of guys before the meeting. I said, "Well, how do you think this is working?" And one of them said, "Well, it's fine. Yeah, it's fine, man. We've been going 11 years." And the other guy said, "Well, what do you mean by that? How's it going?" I said, "Are you seeing people show up in recovery? Yeah, are you seeing people who show up in the group?" They looked at each other, and one guy said, "You know anybody?" The other guy said, "No, do you?" Now, come on. I don't know. I don't care what you're selling. If you can't make a sale in 11 years, it may be time to take a look at what you're selling. Yeah, something wrong, man. You know, that effectiveness, we don't look at that very much. We just sort of do stuff because it's the way it's done. A lot of times you go into a town and say, "Why do you do it that way?" You say, "Well, it's the way it was when I got here." Yeah, sacred tradition. And so when it comes to doing effectiveness, I'll give you this last example. At same prison I was talking about a little earlier, they got in a new population, they wanted to set up something, went over, met with them, went through the management drill. And then we got to looking. Now, I've got effectiveness on my mind. My belief is that a program has to fit the environment it's going to serve. Me making up a program before I even see it is silly. I've got to know what I'm dealing with before I can know what tools to use. But we don't often do that. We'll just decide what kind of program we're going to have and just go and lay it on them, you know, see what happens. So I decided to do something I never had done. So I pulled the guys together and I said, "Let's take a look at this thing." So we asked the management group, Who's going to be here? All right, there's going to be about 300 guys, maybe a little over. Mostly young guys. They're going to be from 19 to under 25. Well, it tells us the demographic. That's one important demographic. This is going to be a young group. How long are they going to be there? About 6 months. You know, what do they look like? You know, just the usual kind of stuff to get a picture of what's there. You know, what's your schedule like? All that. So when we left, we understood what that environment was. We understood what the population was. So what we wanted to know was exactly that. It's like diagnosing a patient before you do surgery. And so we left there. We had plenty of information. So we pulled our little bunch together and said, okay, let's take a look at that and see what we can do. 6 months sound like a pretty good chunk of time, eh? It means 24 meetings. What can you do in 24 meetings that's going to be effective? What's really critically important to get across? What we wound up with in responding to what we thought was effective, and we've just finished our first cycle of it, we decided to target two things. One was a genuine first step. If you don't do a genuine first step, the rest of it is philosophy 101. And means little to nothing. Our program is based on surrender. And so I don't care if we didn't get anything but that done, as long as we can get that done. If we don't get that done, thump it up. So we wanted to get that done. We also wanted to get a working knowledge of the program. A lot of people say somebody like in jails, I hear it all the time, they're all right, they've already been to AA. Been to AA doesn't assure any learning. A lot of people stay here just long enough to get confused, you know, and then leave with, I mean, absolutely no idea what AA is. And so we wanted to have a working knowledge, not like we did with history today, but we want a working knowledge about what is it that shapes this program? What is it that's critical to its work? And so we talk about groups and meetings and sponsorship and slogans and all of the things that we use to have a working knowledge so that it's not just go to AA and see what happens. You know, working knowledge. And then the third thing was speakers. We had eight meetings of each. We want eight speakers. Because I don't think there's anything that has more power than one alcoholic bearing his soul to another alcoholic. So that's just a simple little sketch of something that we're not inclined to do much, you know. So trouble with history, you bet I am. Trouble with our terrain at the moment, you bet I am. Giving up, you bet I'm not. And I hope you don't either. I hope if you got stuff that worries you, move in on that sucker. Do something, man. And watch what happens. Thanks. Yeah, Al, you had a question? Let me take off on that a little bit. I'll try to repeat that, Al. What Al's talking about is certainly the impact of having mandatory meetings be unsuccessful in terms of the guy. And he's wanting to talk a little bit more about what's the impact on the group. My experience has been that it's no real impact. It's not a negative impact so much. It does something to the climate. It does something to the climate of the group. It contributes to that kind of practices of not giving good, warm welcomes to people. And so I think it creates a climate in that of a sort of an edge of negativity. And for each one of us who avoids doing it or who criticizes it being done, I think we pay a little price in that, in our spiritual condition. So I think there is a loss to the group. I tell you, one of the most crude things I've seen, I won't name the city, but I was in a city, it wasn't this one. But I was in a city a while back that's historically important in AA, and we went to a club, that big building thing, a very nice place, and there was a big sign posted on the door, out on front. We do not sign papers. I thought, where the hell is welcome? You know, I mean, that's normally what say is welcome when you got an open thing. But I thought, boy, that says a lot more about the person reading the sign, the person who wrote the sign, that it does the person reading it. That's exactly what I'm talking about, is that when you get that kind of a negative attitude, it's going to be hard to define who the pure one is that comes in. And so I just think it breeds some intolerance and impatience with us that we can't afford, that hardens us up where we need to be recognizing that, just like Phil, I understand that I need him more than he needs me. I don't care where he came from. That's his business. Yeah. Anybody else? Jeanette. Jeanette's asking about men going into women's institutions and women going into men's. I'm all for it with some precautions. Personally, the thing I look for I don't want to run risk of getting in trouble with this, but I'm not a sexist, but I'm a realist. And in recovery, some women have a little trouble adjusting to appropriate kinds of relationship with men. Most have had some troubling relationships with men. And so very often you'll see somebody who deals with that in a sort of provocative, sexually oriented type of behavior. And you just got to watch for that. If a lady who goes in there and handles herself like a lady will absolutely, have a good experience. But somebody who is still a little uncertain about how to relate or getting over some wounds or some, they're sitting duck. Let me come back to that one. I think one of the cruelest things I've seen was about a year ago. There was not only cruel, it was stupid. But I went up the other end of the state speaking to prison, and a young lady picked up a 60-day chip in a medium custody male penitentiary. And I thought, God, how stupid can you get? I mean, for God's sake, come on, man. I mean, that is a terrible experience for that lady and for those people. You know, when somebody comes into a penitentiary, they think you're Bill Wilson or Lois Wilson. You know, and it was just off the wall. You know, and so I really think there's a very important thing for careful, thoughtful timing. And then, I don't care what the history is, if there's a good, solid presence in the program and those kinds of personal issues are quieted down, then that can do great work. I mean, there's some fine. We've got one woman who's been sponsoring a medium custody male prison for 25 years, and her husband carries her sword. That's just about the way it works, too. It's a little different standard with it doesn't sound fair, but from my standpoint, it's a little different standard with women into male facilities than it is men into female. It's just different. I had a women's prison one time when I was supervising stuff, but I would never go into a female facility without a female being with me. And my staff knew that when I was working around one of them, that they better not let me get isolated with a female. And as for my protection, there's a little different standard to that thing. It just has to do with that male-female relationship thing. And I've seen staff fired on both genders, staff who work there. But men will get into trouble in a female facility more than females will in a male. And so it's just a strange deal. I'll give you one just story not a long story, but just a headline that shows you what happens if you don't watch about having good, stable members in going into these facilities. Well, I'll tell you the city of Montreal. The city of Montreal is a great city, but it's surrounded by seven penitentiaries. It's just like the walls of the city almost, and they're just scattered around Montreal. AA was kicked out of six of the seven. And what happened, a bunch of female, sort of a feminist agenda, started taking on a social cause and calling it AA. And they wound up with some pretty bizarre kinds of situations. And AA was, they weren't asked to leave, they were told to leave six out of seven facilities. And so that preparation, the readiness, the solidity is critically important. I don't like to take anybody, I don't care who it is, I don't like to take anybody into a facility until they've got a minimum of 6 months, and that would be with a sponsor. I wouldn't let anybody go in under a year on their own to where they're going to take a responsibility. Now, that's strange for me to say because I went in 2 weeks after I was released. It doesn't mean I'm a superstar hero in it, but it's just back in those days. I mean, hell, we had the wounded on the firing line. I mean, And so it's a little different standard now. That so I do think it's an awfully important deal with the readiness to carry the message. Yeah, Clara, yeah. Yeah, what she's asking about is just my own personal take on clubs. I'm an expert on it because we don't have one in my community, so naturally I'm an expert. I have been involved in clubs. I was on the board of one in Charlotte for a while, and I tell you, it's a tricky kind of an environment. The I'm always a little bit nervous when we get into property kind of stuff. We've got a lot of places that rent space just to conduct the AA meeting. When that happens, the primary purpose becomes pay to rent. Yeah. And so when you're so caught up in just the survival of keeping the facility, that becomes your focus, you know. And so I've got some concern about that because it really puts an inordinate weight on that kind of a responsibility. I'm a little concerned because of the hangout nature. I mean, that's part of it, but it just gets to be the hangout nature. Long time ago, when I was on the board of the one in Charlotte, I'll tell you the kind of thing that happened. We had a little problem. It wasn't a little problem. We had a big problem come up in Charlotte where women who were calling in for help, and we got all of our 12-step calls directly then. You know, that was predated treatment. The club fellow that answered the phone would write down the name and the address and the phone number. Well, we started getting feedback about folks going out and taking advantage of the person that called for help. Well, that's a hell of an introduction to what's called Alcoholics Anonymous. So that was caused a lot of trouble. And we're not the police force, you know, but obviously that was something that was hugely damaging to the welfare of everybody involved. So we just started monitoring the stuff. And what it was a guy that I knew well. I mean, he really knew him well, and he had good vision. So when somebody would write down an address, it takes a while back then, it still does, takes a while to find a woman ready to go out on a 12-step call. And so he would write down the address and go make the call. And then when somebody else came back, they were dealing with a victim rather than an alcoholic. And so it took a while to do that. But that's, so you get a lot of stuff that can happen. Sometimes you'll see clubs that work very well, but they have got to be managed well, and if they turn in to I'll just tell you one other city. I won't call the name of this one, but I'll tell you one other city where the old original club, the original place in that city, is barely surviving. And it's surviving because the last time I talked to any of them, there were five or six of the original board who refused to give up. But they also refused to go to meetings there because rather than being a good place for meeting, it was aggressively taken over by people who were not AA members by definition. Well, they might have called themselves AA members. But these were people who just flatly defied tradition and said that they weren't going to abide by that stuff. And so what's happened, they're protecting the legend, but it's living on borrowed time. Yeah. So you got all kinds of stuff that can happen, and I think our tradition says it very well that in that sixth tradition that we don't it doesn't say don't have clubs, but they are a separate entity from Alcoholics Anonymous. They are a separate entity, and that tradition says that we ought not to endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. And then the real key is less problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our purpose. And so that's what happens. You know, if they're not extremely well managed, they'll get so caught up in dealing with these ongoing problems, the economic support, that the primary purpose really gets into some difficulty. So they're a real challenge. They're a real challenge. I just say one other thing about it. In my little old town, I'm not a member of it. I used to be, but there's a building in every community in America, I think, back in the Second World War, under the some program, WPA, they built these community buildings all over the country. And they served their purpose, and then a lot of them became abandoned. And one in our little community was abandoned. And the guys said, sorry, I was not there when AA started in that town. But the guys that started, and I knew them all, they started it, went to the city and asked if they could take the building if they renovated it. And that was a huge job. So the city said, well, yeah, we're not going to use the thing. And they got it for $1 a year. Well, now, if you really want to split an infinitive, you could say that that meant we were paying our way. It might push it a little. And so we became proprietors and by renters of a building, by $1 a year. Worked out fine till something broke. And then guess what happened? The city's building had a problem, not us. So, you see, what we've done for the last 40 years is tap dance around the tradition. And that's what so often happens is we can rationalize our way around anything, and that's what we've done is rationalize our way around that. So that's a tough issue. It really is. They're very legitimate. They're written about in AA literature. And bottom line, what I'm saying is that my experience has been that unless they are really well managed by thoughtful, conscientious people, they're going to get in a lot of trouble. But, yeah, well, she's asking about the towns where mine would be a good example of that, where you've got a lot of little meetings that, around town. In a little town, of our collective population is probably not 20,000, and we've got at least 30 meetings a week. But how many groups? One. There is no way to do it. I do want to turn it into a tradition meeting, because that's where it's at. It says that every group's autonomous. You know, that every group can function as they wish. And we've got the most liberal definition of a group that could possibly be. So you're a group if you say you are. There's no quality control agent that says, no, you don't qualify. And so the group's autonomous except what? When it affects other groups or AA as a whole. You know, I have the impression a lot of times that I was over at a group one night at a different time, not my group, and they were doing one of these nose counts. You know, I don't think we have a clue how many members we got because what they do is just when a poll comes out, it says, everybody consider themselves a member of this group. Well, I'm sitting there with people, they're people from my own group, members of my own group, stuck their hand up. I'm the only guy in the room that didn't stick his hand up. And a guy beside me said, why didn't you stick your hand up? You come here. I said, I don't belong here. This is not my group. And I've had the distinct impression that if we rang a great big bell in my community and said, everybody report to your home group, we'd have empty halls. Yeah? Because what we created is a kind of a nomadic society that just sort of drifts around. You heard old Muhammad Ali float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. That's what a lot of our membership does. They kind of just float from one little place to another, suck a little pollen, and then go somewhere else, you know. And so it's free to do that. Free to do that. Every member's autonomous, too. But, my God, when you pose a question like that, you can see the challenge because we've got no police force, we've got no quality control, we've got no way of what I've done personally for the last, God, at least 25 years, maybe 30. And the best I could tell, I am really not just headstrong about it. I'm some of that. I like to think I'm dedicated. Most people think I'm obstinate. But either way, when I've gone into a town, every time I've moved, you always have that kind of out-of-the-groove discomfort. You know, you're out of your familiar group. So every time I've done that, I've looked around and tried to find a group. A lot of times, this one I'd like to just plug in and relax a while, you know, because I'm always so high energy. But for the last 25 or maybe 30 years, I have never been able to find a group that gave me the kind of base that I need to operate from. I don't mean to get what I need, but that I need to operate from, because my group is a major tool. And if I get into a group that I just won't stay, and it is not anger, It's just that I can't do my work without tools. And my group is my tool. And so what I've had to do in every town is start a new group. And that's been in every town that I've been in for the last 25, 30 years. The one we're in right now, I'll just tell you real quick how we started that, and it's part of what I'm going to send to them, is we started a group. I was taking a bunch of guys through the big book, you know, doing a big intensive big book workshop. When you get through with something like that, you have some really pumped up people. I mean, they're really pumped up. Well, what I was running into was that they weren't all in my group. Sometimes they were pumped up and had nowhere to go. And so they started coming to me and said, man, we got to start a group for people that are getting through this stuff. And I said, well, do that. They said, well, we want you to go with us. I said, okay, but I'm the founder of the group I'm in. And then I thought it over, and I saw that group was pretty well settled in. And they really wanted to do something that had some bold feelings about it. So what we did, I just tell you this real quick. We had 10 people that wanted to do something. So we pulled them together. And it's really interesting. I'm a brainstorm guy. I know you'd never believe that, but I'm a brainstorm type of guy. I love brainstorm because, and you know what I'm talking about, is that thing where you don't think about it, you just throw it out. You know, say, what do you think? We're going to try to do this. How do you put that in motion? And then brainstorm, it means you throw out the idea. You don't have to explain it or defend it. You just put it out there. If you put it out, it goes up. So we decided to use that. Said, all right, if you want to start a group, and I chaired me. I said, if you want to start a group, what is one quality that you would insist on having in that group? If I ask you that, I guarantee you, you'd have one. Your stability would be one. You know, some sense of who really belong here. But I said, just do it. And so when you're doing that, I always say, we call it priming the pump. Or I do. You have to prime the pump, get it going, you know. So when I threw it out, we talked about it just a minute. And I threw one. I said, structure. Now, I like structure because, and I did explain it. Just said, structure. Put it up there. And then it broke loose. And when we finished in 12 minutes, we had 19 what we later started to call goals. These were the qualities we wanted in that group. And I'll send her a copy of that. The qualities, what is it we want to have that if we start a group, what do we want it to do? And so we laid that out. When we got through, and I didn't want just 19, so I arbitrarily put in rule 62 to make it 20. Is don't take yourself too damn seriously, you know. And we don't. We have a hoot. We said then that we wanted it to be a group that was characterized by action. And said, okay, well, how do we do that? And so what we did, we started to spell out ways that people could be active. And I forgot it was in the Third Legacy Manual, but I knew that's what governed it. I drew a circle, and we just started listing committees. And we listed 10 committees. CPC, PI, Treatment, CFC, Grapevine Literature, Newsletter. We ain't even met. We've already got a newsletter going. And then the regular officer, GSR, and all that. We got through, we had 10. And I didn't plan it this way, but I recognized it. And so we got through. Somebody said, well, where the devil are we going to get members for these committees? I said, no problem. It's already solved. What are you talking about? I said, well, I've been counting the house. We got 10 members, 10 committees. They're full. All we got to do is add members. And that's exactly what we did. Everybody took a committee. And so all at once, we're an organized group. We've got a plan of action. So we put it in action. We met. The first night we met, we had 40-some people there and never sent out a flyer or announcement. 45 people. We had a newcomer committee. The guy that was the chair of the newcomer committee one night said, we ain't getting no newcomers. And I said, why don't you start a newcomer group? And he said, you didn't understand what I said. We don't have any newcomers. I said, yeah, I understood that. Start a newcomers group. He said, well, hell, that's dumb. That's dumb. I said, well, do it anyway. Remember that bus I was talking about drove up to that place? My God, man, you let somebody know you got a newcomer group? The first night, I counted them. 41 people came to the newcomers group. We have a game, even with treatment disappeared. We still get people because there's a hunger for that kind of thing. And so that was the way we did it. so that we not only created a fellowship we crave, but we created an instrument to bring a new energy, some new life there. And in all honesty, we have to block vote to keep from dominating our district. When we go to district, we usually over half the membership. And so we have to deliberately stack our vote against, not for us, but to push somebody else in and just to keep from dominating. The other side of that word autonomy, we think of it as privacy and, you know, being able to do our own business. Autonomy does not mean isolation. So I think a part of how we need to evaluate is what kind of an influence are we on the groups around us? How helpful are we to the groups around us? And so I tell you that little thing about now we're more organized and more structured than the average group. But I wouldn't have it any other way. We have a marvelous time with our stuff. We really have a good time, but we do a lot of work. We have 4 prison commitments, 4 rehab and detox commitments, a CPC and PI committee, a treatment facility committee, you name it. We've got something going on. And I'm sorry? It's not a big group. We'll run, give and take, we'll run 40 to 45, somewhere in there. I mean, you build up a lot of long roster over the years, but in terms of real bodies that are drinking coffee, yeah, probably. Yeah, we get some visitors, but that's who the soldiers are. Now, you're talking about the size there. Yeah. Anybody else? Everybody has a job available. There are some people who insist on being spectators. But they're going to be illusory if they do, and they're not going to be real comfortable if they don't, because they're going to get hit on a regular basis. So we don't encourage the just drink coffee syndrome. But we don't make them uncomfortable. We just want to make it uncomfortable enough to do something about it, you know, and move on in. So we want to be welcome in that. By the way, those committees are not just for people who are finished products. It's a great place to put newcomers. A newcomer can lick a stamp just as good as I can. Probably got a better wet tongue than I have. So everybody can do something. They can lift a box or something, you know. So they're a great place to integrate people in the group. Paul would have done that. It is tough to do. It is tough to do. I think y'all could hear what Paul was saying. That you got this sort of magnet over here that runs away some of the older, more solid type of members.
What I'm concerned about mostly is the newcomers. Because we have more meetings there than anything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is a troubling quality. And the reason that I mentioned it earlier, and I just reiterated, the reason these things, these lightweight types of meetings grow so prolifically is because they are popular. They are they're no strain. You know, they just go in and take what you want and leave. I mean, God, how... That's a strange way to treat a self-centered program, is to just look after me. But it's popular. It is a dilemma. And we have the same thing, but we're no different. You got to recognize a group like ours is not going to be attractive to everybody. A lot of people want to be where they're comfortable. They want people who are not sober enough to be dressed up and cleaned up and not cussing every other word. You still want to sort of feel a little bit of that environment, not get too good too quick. And so it's a seductive environment. You know, it really is. I worry about that. We've got one in my town, and I swear to God, it is shaky would be a very kind way to put it. It is really, really more inclined to spread the disease than the recovery. But what do you do? I mean, you can't police. I'll just tell you this one thing as far as, you know, I've got to start with me. If I want to do something about the things I'm talking about, number one, I've got to be the strongest member I'm capable of being. I want to be as well informed as I can be so that I understand the issues and know what people are talking about and can have some kind of evaluation capability about what's wrong or right. So I want to be well informed. I want to be a good, solid group member. The other thing is... I don't know of any nice way to say this. Over the years, I've found that I have simply had to part company with a lot of people. An awful lot of folk in AA. I'm sorry. But a lot of folks just only want to grow so far. If you want to look at the point where most of the work stops with people who are doing, really trying to do recovery, take a look at Six Step. And you'll find where I believe most of the sort of the backing out of moving into to what we're talking about here will occur. And then from that point on, what happens is pretty soon on out the door. So, but when I say part company, I don't mean that I have to quit speaking to people. I'm a pretty easygoing, friendly type of guy most of the time. And so I don't put people down. But I don't hang out with somebody. You know, that I don't hang out with somebody that's not on the same wavelength. I'm not that hungry for companionship. Yeah, I had a guy I've known for years stopped me the other day in a meeting and said, "I want to talk a minute." Now he said, "I just saw somebody the other day and we was having lunch with a guy." He said, "I didn't call a name," and he said, "You know what that guy said about you?" Now I said, "No." He said, "Well, you want me to tell you?" I said, "No." And he said, "You mean you don't want to know what's up?" I said, "No, I really don't." And he said, "Why?" I said, "My friend, I wouldn't waste 10 seconds of my time or attention on some stupid junk like you're talking about. I mean, I don't care what it is. I have no interest whatsoever in that. Yeah, I'm not going to waste my time with that. I've got so much attention that I can give, and I'm going to be careful where I give it. And I'm not going to hang around, you know, like gossip. You know, you can soft-pedal gossip all you want to. But gossip is a tremendously destructive force. And I'm just like that example there, I'm as much a part of it if I listen to it as I am if I spread it. And so when I hear that stuff, I just don't have time for that stuff. It's not. So when I find people that just are not interested in doing anything, I'm not going to be unfriendly with them. But you can bet that that's not where I'm going to be spending my time. And so I just accept that sometimes I've just got to part company with folks. And I'll do it. I hope I don't have to, but I sure do it in a heartbeat. Yeah. Anybody else? You got? Yeah. Dave. Yeah. Well, you know, drugs got opinions on everything, but I just tell you this. Sometimes if I do a workshop on sponsorship, I don't try to tell anybody how to do it. Well, I might infer a little something, but I mean, I don't teach sponsorship. When I do a sponsorship workshop, right now the way I'm doing them, I will help the group determine what they think a sponsor, if you're looking for a sponsor, what do you want? What are you looking for? And I'm not asking you that. And I'm saying that's just one of the things. But what are you looking for? How do you get it? What causes it to fail? I like to go through what is this sponsorship thing, not what does Tom Iverson think about it. But if I get a group of people, I want to get that group. They don't have to agree on everything, but I want to do brainstorming and draw out, well, what is it? See, most people, unfortunately, not, I don't know if it's most people, but an awful lot of people, either wind up with a sponsor assigned to them, or they wind up with just seeing somebody in the hall and saying, "Will you sponsor me?" "Yeah, we'll give it a try." Well, I mean, that's a little too casual. If I'm going to let somebody engage in my life, you can bet there's going to be more to it than that. But see, a lot of times we treat that sponsorship too casually, and we wind up with a lot of blundering around. Be like a medication thing. I mean, you think you want somebody that you met in the hall to advise you about medication or something? So I like to do a lot more thoughtful thing than just my own particular bias about the thing. My belief is that it's a very important personal relationship. My sponsor is the only person on this planet. I mean the only one who has unlimited access to my life. Nobody else on this planet is invited to walk into my life, but my sponsor is. Because I hired that sucker to help me stay alive, and I expect him to do that. So I put a real standard on sponsorship that the way I like to go about it is that real thoughtful kind of a way. Who sponsors who? You read it a mile away. Yeah. Anybody else? Tell you what, you guys have been just a magnificent group to work with. You're just unbelievable. And just think, I'm going to do the sunrise services and the foot washing tomorrow morning. So, Carol, I'll turn you back over to the president.